to the panel. This is a panel on inequalities and social policies. I suppose I should introduce myself. I'm Eric Gordy, not from LSU, but I found a way to LSU. Also a researcher on policy and society in the Balkans. If you'll indulge me, I'll say a few words about why this is interesting to me before introducing the speakers, I think what you'll be hearing now is a lot of what's happening on the level of policy in the social spaces where it's formulated. I am coordinating a project right now in the region called Inform, about informal practices. So we're asking the question, what happens to these policies on the ground level at the point where they might or might not be implemented? And some of the things that we're finding with this, of course, there is a whole set of policies that have been enacted with the purpose of promoting social equality and reducing inequality. I won't surprise you at all if I tell you that that very often they run into two big problems. One of them is that laws and policies are passed by parliaments in states that do not have the capacity to implement them, and so they are partially implemented or not implemented at all. The second big problem is related, and this will also surprise none of you. That is the problem of enforcement. That very often policies are enacted that are excellent on paper and are never enforced, either for the reason I've just given, lack of capacity, or more often because of lack of political will. The example that comes out most strongly in our analysis is the law on domestic violence in Serbia, which is an excellent law. Provides very clear definitions and very strong mechanisms of enforcement. The difficulty that is encountered is that no police forces and no judges appear to be willing to enforce this law. So it exists, but has no effect. But let me tell you about just two more findings that might be a little bit less unsurprising to you. And one of them is... one phenomenon that we're exploring in detail is what happens when policy clashes with or fails to cohere with ground-level practices that are affirmed by culture and by social relations over time. Most often, what people would expect to find looking at these is that the effect is usually negative. It means that there is blockage of initiatives to promote social equality. But clashes between law and practice are not always negative. So that in one of our studies on entrepreneurship among women in the Southeast European states, what we're finding is some expected things, that there are people who enter political parties in order to promote their businesses, for example, and some less expected things, including that folk practices related to gender, things that we might call stereotypes, are being channeled through business practice to create a form of entrepreneurship involving a much higher level of care. For people within the enterprise than is normally the practice in privatized industry. The second finding that we're making relatively regularly is that we encounter pretty often a conflict between the policy goals. This commonly falls under labels like neoliberalism, but I don't like this term neoliberalism because it encompasses too many things without explaining any one of them. But in particular, all of the practices related to promoting privatization come into conflict with widely and strongly held folk values, including the value of egalitarianism, which means that sometimes this is expressed in terms of nostalgia for policies of the communist period, which cohered more closely with the folk value of egalitarianism. egalitarianism, but if you look closely at egalitarianism in the region, it predates the emergence of communism, and it appears to have outlived it. I think what all of this adds up to is that it's probably a good thing to supplement analysis of policies with analysis of what happens to policies when they put their feet on the ground. And in this evening's session, we'll have two presentations, and if I've understood the summary, so we will begin with Will, who will talk about what's been attempted so far and how far it's got in achieving quality-related results. And then Anna will talk about ideas that are being generated related to possible policies in the future, and some responses maybe to what's worked and what hasn't worked. So the way we'll do this is that each presenter will present for somewhere around 20 minutes, which should leave us a good deal of time for discussion after the presentations. And with that, I will stop talking because nobody here came to listen to me, and I'll hand it over to our first presenter. Well,
thanks very much. If I can add to that very scholarly introduction by some interesting facts about inequality in the Western Balkans and former Yugoslavia today. It's mainly going to be talking about where we are at the moment, and then in terms of inequality, and then Edo will follow with some thoughts about what to do about it.
Really?
Well, what has been attempted in terms of social policies. So I think inequality has obviously risen up the academic agenda in recent years with the publication of the book by Piketty and a book by Stiglitz and so on. People are becoming much more aware of the issue, partly because inequality has increased so much in so many countries. And the same has happened in the Western Balkans and the countries of former Yugoslavia to some extent. But I think in those countries it's not really risen up the policy agenda to the same extent as there's been academic interest. The policy attention in the past, at least, has been focused much more on the question of poverty, so looking at the bottom end of the income distribution without thinking too much about what's the relationship between the bottom end and the top end of the income distribution. And the I would say probably the initial policy ideas about poverty were inspired by the World Bank, which encouraged countries to develop something called the Poverty Reduction Strategy Papers in the late 90s, early 2000s, I think it was, in all the countries of what was then the Western Balkans, including Croatia. Of course, Croatia has now joined the EU, it's not part of that group. But those PRSPs, as they were known, really focused, were based upon the theory, a sort of trickle-down theory of poverty reduction. And the idea was that if you could boost, if you could, you know, support the development of new businesses, small businesses, develop industry in general through a favourable business environment, and get the support for the business sector, that would sort of generate jobs and create incomes and eventually hopefully solve the problem. And to some extent that did work in the 2000s, because between about 2002 up to the period of the economic crisis, there was a big economic boom in the region with economic growth rates of about 5% on average for over those sort of 7 or 8 year period, which did bring many people out of poverty, did create jobs, and did do something to solve some of the problems. But of course, with the onset of the economic crisis, which had a huge impact on the Western Balkans. The growth came to a shuddering halt with two recessions in 2009-2012. Very slow growth in terms of recovery. Perhaps it was the region in the world that was most affected by the economic crisis, or at least one of the regions, in terms of the depth of the recessions that followed and the rise in unemployment that followed. So that all the progress that was made in the early 2000s was clearly tremendously tenuous, and there's been an increase in poverty since then. The sort of response to that has been organisations such as UNDP and other international organisations working on in the field in trying to respond to the growth of poverty have come up with the idea of the so-called marginal groups, and much of their work is looking at how can you solve the problem of the marginal groups. So it's, you know, the disabled, the young, well, it's almost everybody actually, apart from perhaps white middle-aged males, but it's women, young people, old people, disabled people, people with less good education, and so on. But the point being, I think the sort of implicit theory is that basically that poverty is a sort of deviation or an aberration to be solved by targeted policies. It's an aberration in the market economy, which should generate incomes for everybody, unless there's some specific problem. It's not seen that poverty is an intrinsic problem of capitalism, or at least of the type of capitalism which is being developed in the region. And so that's a sort of thought which I'll come back to perhaps a bit later on. We can talk sort of further about that. There is the World Bank has taken a new view, I'd say, talking today in recent years about inclusive growth, trying to make growth more inclusive, right? And sort of abandoning the trickle-down theory and trying to sort of move in some different directions. But that's not really the theme of what I'm talking about today. I'm really talking about inequality rather than poverty, although they're clearly both very much related. The reason, sort of motivation for the talk is a research fellowship that I've recently started at the LSE's International Inequalities Institute, which is sort of over in one of the towers, one of the other buildings of the LSE. And we have a joint fellowship with three scholars from the Western Balkans. Gorana Kristic and Jelena Zarkovic Rakic, apologise for the spelling mistake there, from the Economics Faculty in Belgrade, and Nermin Oruc from Sarajevo. And they'll be visiting fellows here in January and February, and we'll be carrying out some research, or more in-depth research, into the question of inequality. And this is really this talk today is more of an introduction to that, some initial sort of thoughts about it. But the project is looking at trying to identify the extent of inequality in four of the Yugoslav successor states. It's looking at, we'll be covering Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia and Slovenia. So it's not the Western Balkans, it's not the whole of former Yugoslavia, but it's these four countries which two of which are Western Balkan states, meaning that they're EU candidates, and two of which are actually EU member states, Croatia and Slovenia. And the question is, a sort of interesting research question, I think, is that all these four countries were 30 years ago part of the same state, Yugoslavia, and then when Yugoslavia broke up, they moved off in completely different directions, and with setting up very different types of capitalism with very different consequences for inequality, as we'll see in a moment. And then we want to understand, or at least try to understand or study the factors that determine the level of labour income inequality, because it seems that the most income is generated by labour and therefore most inequality is related to the labour market. And then what have been the role of different welfare policies? So we'll be looking at education and employment policies in particular in determining the pattern of income inequalities. So as you probably all know, the previous system from which these four countries emerged was a system of market socialism which attempted to reconcile efficiency and equity through the system of self-management, which is a system of workplace democracy, and social ownership. So social ownership got rid of the capital generation of income. So there were no shareholders. There was the socially owned enterprises were essentially a bit like NHS trusts in a way. They were not owned by private persons, but they're not owned by the state either. So they were held in trust on behalf of society and managed by the managers who were elected by the workforce. And the main point being is this, what you think, how do you think about the reality of the participatory nature of the self-management system, the communist or socialist system which was found in Yugoslavia was very different to that which was found behind the Iron Curtain in the Soviet bloc. There were studies of inequality, wage inequality, for example, in former Yugoslavia, because what seemed to happen was that enterprises which had bigger capital stock were able to pay their workers more. So there was a sort of intra-sectoral inequality of incomes between workers doing the same, performing the same work, but having different endowments of capital in their companies. Nevertheless, it was a decentralized market economy and with interesting features, which I think people have forgotten now. I mean, you see a lot of statements in the literature on the successor states, the Western Balkans and so on, which refer to the previous state-owned centrally planned system in Yugoslavia, which actually was not anything whatsoever like that. There was a fairly extensive welfare system based upon so-called Bismarckian and universal concepts, with major benefits provided on a contributory basis and also non-contributory cash benefits. And all of this led to a fairly equal level of income distribution overall, despite the problems I mentioned. And there were studies of income inequality. In 1968, for example, the World Bank study found for Yugoslavia as a whole a standardised household income Gini coefficient of 0.24%. For those of you who don't know this Gini index, it varies between 0 and 1, where 0 means perfect equality and 1 means perfect inequality. In other words, that all the income is held by one person and nobody else has any. So it sort of varies on this sort of 0.0, in practice, from about 0.2 to about 0.6, perhaps. It's the range of the world and its coefficient. So in Yugoslavia, it was pretty much at the lower end of that. From a theoretical point of view, we see that the successor states emerged from this common system, and there's a certain degree, therefore, of legacy involved. And you might think, if, since they have a common legacy, they would evolve in a common way, but that hasn't been the case. Partly because of the different effects of wars and conflicts, and partly because of the differences in the pace and pattern of privatisation, the speed of reform. So there were early reformers, Croatia and Macedonia, for example, which privatised the bulk of the industry in the 1990s. And the late reformers, which came along later, Slovenia and Serbia, privatising in the 2000s. Well, Slovenia actually was more privatising gradually over the whole period. And this gradual nature of the reforms in Slovenia is often held by commentators to be very important in explaining the rather low level of inequality in Slovenia compared to the high level in places like Serbia. Also, the impact of the neoliberal agenda, sorry for using that term, I fully agree that it disguises as much as it reveals, but there were differences in the, let's say, the approach towards the market, elements of welfare, under the influence of different international actors, such as the World Bank and the EU and so on. But the main point is that today, after 30 years, we have, as I mentioned already, very different systems with very different outcomes in terms of inequality. And this can partly be traced to the primary inequality generated by the market economy, what's called the market distribution, and partly to the impact of policy on that, and how far social transfers and social welfare policies moderate the income inequality, and have an effect on reducing inequality. So there's two elements to it. There's the original inequality pre-policy, and then there's the final inequality, the money that, and the resources people have in their pockets, which actually depends upon the tax and benefit system and the various welfare programs and so on. So in the literature there is a model which seems to be sort of relevant to this diverse nature of the evolution of the capitalist systems in the four countries we're looking at. This is, goes by the name of the varieties of capitalism model, which has been developed by people who work primarily in the industrial relations literature field, and therefore emphasises very much the relationships within and between enterprises and the relationships on the labour market and the effect of trade unions. And a lot of the basic idea is that in some countries you have a very strong relationship or a very strong partnership, let's say, between capital and labour. So you have strong trade unions and strong representation in so-called tripartite bodies between the state, the employers, and the trade unions, which negotiate together and come to some sort of social agreement about what the distribution of income, broadly speaking, should look like in different sectors. So you have a sort of sector-level bargaining. And this is a model which is very much used in the core countries in Europe, Germany and France, I think, as well, Netherlands and so on. It's known as the coordinated market economies, in contrast to the so-called liberal market economies, sometimes think about the Anglo-Saxon economies in Britain and the United States, where basically there's a clash between employers and trade unions, this sort of conflict, and each side is trying to do the other down. There's no partnership. It's all about who can wrest as much resources out of the other side as possible. But that's more a competitive type of economy, and it's thought that, I mean, some would argue it's more has a greater sort of efficiency because it's more of a free market basis. And you can see here in the countries that we're looking at, how important are the trade unions in these countries? Is there a link? Is there a difference? And clearly, and it's this one indicator taken from the European Values Survey, percent of respondents with much confidence in trade unions. You can see a very different pattern there. Slovenia, with over half the respondents, have very much confidence in the trade unions, and Serbia, with about 10%. So that reflects more or less the fact that in Slovenia, because of the gradual nature of the transition, a system of coordinated market economies, sometimes called corporatism, has developed.
Which year is this? Sorry, which year? Which year is the date?
I don't know. I can't remember. It's recent. Sorry, look it up. Serbia and Croatia and Macedonia, there's less tripartite, but the institutions of tripartism, tripartite bargaining, are very weak, basically not functioning very well, if at all. So you could see that this type of model could be applied in some ways to these countries. And Slovenia, in fact, has been held up by proponents of this model as the sort of classic model in the amongst the transition countries of a coordinated market economy. in the literature. It's often contrasted with Estonia, which is held to be a highly sort of liberal market economy. But I think if we apply it to the Western Balkans, we could perhaps begin to talk about what types of, what varieties of capitalism have been developed in those countries. So moving on quickly to the actual explanation or the exploration of inequality. This is the currently 2015, I know the year of this one, the year of the previous one, 2015 data for the Gini coefficient of what's called equivalized disposable income, which basically means you're doing a household survey but you're trying to extract from that an individual measure of income. So you take into account the number of people in the household and so on. And this is before pensions and social transfer. So this is the market distribution. And what and this is taken from Eurostat, this data. And what you can see here very clearly is that there's an extraordinary difference between Serbia and Slovenia. It's the thing that comes out, hits you in the eyes there. Croatia and Macedonia are somewhere in the middle. But Serbia has about the most unequal income distribution in Europe, whereas Slovenia has about the most equal, one of the most equal distributions in Europe. And the levels of these coefficients is actually 62%, right? We could call it between 0 and 1 or 0 and 100 here. It's rescaled 0 to 100, so it's 62%, which is very high. I mean, it's extraordinary. Now, what's the reason behind this? Well, I'm going to conclude at the end that there are basically three reasons. One is the path-dependent nature of the transition. The second one is the different type of capitalism which has been developed, looking actually not just at the varieties of capitalism literature, but trying to explain the political economy of the capitalist systems and discussing, I mean, I won't discuss it in detail, so it's not time, but just to try to start to think about the concept of political capitalism as a third model of a third economic system, as a distinct economic system in comparative economic systems literature. In the past, people talked about central planning versus the market. With the demise of the Soviet system, there's not much central planning going on anymore, so people talk about varieties of capitalism. But there is some recent work looking at saying there's a political capitalism with a very strong role of the political ruling elite on the economy, essentially, is a very much distinct type of capitalism. So I'll come back to that. Time already, but okay. So, just drawing on the work of Gorana Krstić a little bit here, she's been investigating these household budget surveys and so-called SILC surveys, which is the EU household budget survey method, and she identifies that one of the big explanatory factors of the income inequality is related to the quantity and quality of employment. So, for example, in Serbia, where you find 18% of persons living in households with very low work intensity, which was one of the variables picked up in this survey, compared to 10% in the EU. And almost half of persons in the lowest income quintile, that's the lowest 20%, live in households with very low work intensity. So, I mean, it's not surprising, really, that if you live in a household where there's nobody at work, then you're going to have low income. And this is the distribution from these surveys, because they're done in every EU country, and now in the Western Balkans as well, some in Serbia and Macedonia. And you see here, this is reflecting the picture we had previously. It seems there's some truth in this, that it's the level of low work intensity. Very many households which don't have access to the labour market, which is very high in Serbia and relatively low in Slovenia, so that might explanatory factor. And if you put these two things together, the Gini coefficient on the vertical axis and the low work intensity on the horizontal axis, you can see there is some sort of relationship there between these two things, but it's not the whole explanation by any means. And the other part of her approach is to look not just at the quantity of employment, but the quality of employment. And so she argues that even people who are in work in the Western Balkans, or many people in work also experience poverty, and there's this is a big explanation of the high levels of income inequality in the labour market. She finds in Serbia, for example, in 2014, almost 13% of the employed were part-time workers, 24% were self-employed, and 18% were temporary workers. And this is precarious jobs which don't generate much income. So self-employed and part-time workers are exposed to poverty, which gives rise to income inequality. And then there's some more information there about the particular case of Serbia, which is just sort of pinning that down. But if we just look at the comparison across countries on some of these quality of work variables, or one of them anyway, own-account workers, own-account workers, self-employed as a percent of total employment. You can see here again, very different pattern emerging in between Serbia and Slovenia, at least, where there's a high proportion of employment is now in self-employment, in this precarious type of work. So at the low level of income, it's both people who are out of work and people who are in work. So if we turn back to this Gini coefficient again, what you can see here in this slide is the Gini coefficient for all countries in Europe, plus Serbia and Macedonia. And you can see that I've put in three different measures of the Gini coefficient. And it's difficult to see them for each individual country, but these lines, these sort of vertical diagonal lines, show the sort of averages across all countries for these three different measures of the Gini coefficient. The black line here, this one, being the market-generated inequality that we saw before, and you can see there that Serbia is at the top and Slovenia is at the bottom. And then you have what happens when you introduce pensions, because obviously a lot of these people are actually elderly people who are out of the labour market on pensions. So with pensions, the income distribution improves because those people have been given an income, the income has been transferred to them even though they're not working. But the pattern still remains pretty much the same between Serbia and Slovenia, and actually all countries. It's slightly variable, but it remains pretty similar. And then you get down to the social transfers when you move from the red line to the blue line. And this is where you take into account the social policy, at least in terms of social transfers. How much does that reduce inequality? And you can see that although it reduces inequality in all countries, the overall pattern between countries is remaining pretty much the same. So whatever way you look at it, the contrast between Serbia and Slovenia remains. And these are those Gini coefficients just for the Western Balkan countries that we're looking at compared to the EU. The first vertical bar being the market Gini, and then the pensions, and then the social, what happens when you introduce social transfers. And you can see the impact, the redistributive impact of these things. The yellow vertical bar here is the effect of the social transfers, and you can see in Serbia actually the effect of it is quite big. And the effect of pensions is the middle bar, blue bar, it's also quite big. So the total overall effect of the welfare state, if you like, is quite big. But the problem is that there's the initial distribution, which is so enormously unequal that even with quite effective social transfers, it's not enough to bring down the high final level of disposable income inequality down to anything like the level in Slovenia. And then there's other ways you can look at this: the ratio between the top 20% and the bottom 20%. Similar sort of picture. That actually enables you to look in a little bit more depth what's going on within this Gini coefficient. And what this is showing is the deciles of income across this. The number one there refers to the bottom 10% of income earners, and 10 here is the top 10% of income earners. You see that in the survey, the top 10% of income earners are getting 27% of all the income, slightly less than the other countries. So you can sort of peer inside the Gini coefficient by using this sort of statistic. And this is doing that again by rearranging slightly, not by each 10%, but by looking at the bottom 50%, which is the red bar, the middle 40%, and the top 10%. So this is the same top 10% again, but just instead of having 10 groups, I've just collapsed it into 3 groups so you can see better what's going on, and then looked at it across all the countries. And what you can see here, that there's big variation between countries. Again, Serbia, you see at the top there, has very low income for the top bottom 50% share, low income share, and a very high income share for the top 10%. And Slovenia is right at the bottom there, with a much more equal distribution between these things. But what's fascinating about this diagram, which shows, is that this middle group is almost equal across all countries. It doesn't vary very much. It's about here, it's 45%, here's 46%, and so on. And so it's the income going to the top 10% is reflected in the lesser income going to the bottom 50%. So you could think of this as the sort of lower class, if you think in sociological terms, middle class, upper class. The middle class has sort of somehow managed to protect themselves. And it's the lower class that have been unable to protect themselves from the, let's say, predatory activity, economic arrangements that benefit the upper class. In the countries at the top of this diagram, in the countries at the bottom of the diagram, whilst the middle class has still protected themselves, the upper class are much less predatory on the incomes of the lower class. And you can see that here, and this is just pinning that down in particular. This coefficient of variation measures the variability. For the lower class, it's about 1, for the upper class, it's about 1, the middle class, there's very little variation. So that just picks that. Say here that the middle classes are protected by their sharp elbows, which was a phrase that Julian Legrand used to use when he was talking about the failure of welfare policies in the UK, but it's clearly something which can be applicable also. Attach the, where is the UK in that? Well, UK is sort of towards the middle top, so. But even more applicable in the Western Balkan countries. And my argument is that upper classes in the predatory societies are able to extract surplus from the lower classes more easily than in other types of society. We hear a lot about the top 1%, and this is the picture for the top 1% in Europe. Serbia is quite high up there, 6.5% income share to the top 1%, much less actually to all three of the other countries. So, final slide. Why does income inequality differ between countries and form Yugoslavia? Well, I can see three explanations at the moment. There may clearly be more explanations. They're not substitutes. They may all be operative. One is the explanation grounded in the stories about the varieties of capitalism and paths of transition, and you then compare the gradualist transition in Slovenia, which without very much privatisation going on initially, but gradually over time a little bit more market being introduced, in contrast to the sort of shock therapy type of transitions which took place in places like Russia and so on. And Serbia, the Serbian transition didn't take place until later in the 2000s, but it had a more shock therapy sort of approach to it. It was more or less saying, sell everything for whatever you can get for it. And the assets basically went to tycoons, disreputable people who sold off the assets and generated massive employment. There's an explanation about labour market institutions, which I've gone into in some length, so I won't repeat that. And there's an explanation about the political system that's been developed, and the elites have transformed themselves since the communist system collapsed, where you could argue that the Slovenian elite was more formed of ex nomenclatura elements, meaning the top political elite who didn't really change much, who resisted reforms, so that's why you get the gradualism. Comparing that to, for example, the Croatian elite, which was more or less changed wholesale overnight when the HDZ came to power and the new political faction came into power.
Thanks very much. Thanks for a very interesting presentation. Let me draw attention to two things that this presentation does. One thing that it does is it confirms a finding that was made by Silvano Volcic in the period shortly after the wars, that where economies had been destroyed, the middle class recovered very quickly, the working class did not, and you saw a very rapid emergence of a new elite that was made up of a combination of former communist officials who had been able to monetize the position that they used to hold, and a lot of chancellors. The other thing that I'm happy to say this presentation does is it confirms a piece of folk wisdom that the path to happiness is to provide people with really good pensions. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, it helps to explain why in the last week you've seen very large protests by pensioners in both Bosnia and Herzegovina and in Serbia. And that's all I will say about that. And now we're going to format the... no, that's not formatted. we're going to find some slides and then listen to Ankalita Tahirai, hopefully telling us what the solution to these inequalities we've just been talking about may be, even though we all know that the solution is universal basic income.
Is it or is it?
Sorry, I made a political statement. We'll begin the presentation without slides, and then we'll do some pixelation.
This is a trick or treat today.
Yeah, this is jazz PowerPoint.
Yeah. Apologies for the presentation. Thank you for the presentation. It's the second time I've been working on that today, and it's still not. It doesn't seem to find the same formatting on the computer. I will start the talk today thinking on something that Will mentioned as well, which was growth. And growth, because it was important in the Western Balkans, because all the welfare systems that were installed in the region were predicated on growth. They were built on necessity and urgency, but they were predicated on growth. And I'll quote here Balding, who wrote that there will be wide agreement that 2% growth is better than 1%, and of course 3% growth is better than 2% growth, but there might be some hesitation as to whether 8% growth is better than 7% growth, in the sense of what would be the implications on the people. Well, whether this could translate into social impacts as well. So the talk for today is meant to be based on understanding the deconstructing the welfare efforts in the region, and also to mention some of the efforts that are currently going on in terms of improving welfare states in the Western Balkans. The welfare states in the Western Balkans were, as Will also mentioned a little bit earlier, they were faced with a situation of emergency. They were built facing market failures, economic failures with industrial collapse and sudden mass unemployment, as well as institutional collapse and in the sense of political issues. There were civil conflict, and also the uncertainty to the hopes for what the change of the system would mean for most people. And there was an explosion in informal strategies, and typically in anomic, in order to prosper, people started to find mechanisms to cope with this sudden unemployment and poverty. These were some of these strategies, including mass migration as a coping mechanism of the poor. At the same time, we have the very imperfect information problem, the data problem, which you can't manage what you don't measure, but for most of the international organizations who went into the countries, you can't measure what you don't manage, was their problem. In this respect, the welfare state that was set in the country was faced with a lot of issues and confusions. So at the time, there was how do we cope with the situation of a lot of needs, but also limited resources, and simultaneously trying to solve everything. So there was a smorgasbord of policy innovations, but minus ideology. So over the years, we see countries which governments which are left right-wing governments who do not renew the mandate of the IMF, which one wouldn't expect that to happen, and we have left-wing governments which were very close to organizations like the IMF, which drives the whole policy-making process in the countries. So Will mentioned a little bit the policy driven based on the growth and poverty reduction strategies as advised by the World Bank. We actually saw that in 2000s, pushed not in all of the countries in the Balkans. We see that in Albania, in Macedonia, Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro. Most of these countries did 1 to 2 reports and then discontinued this approach into policy making, but the most zealous one was Albania, which continued for about 8 years in the attempts to pursue economic growth and produce about 7 reports on the growth and poverty reduction strategy. Other approaches by other international organizations included the Millennium Development Goals and Sustainable Development Goals. How these goals fitted with government policies have not been elaborated enough in the region. Further attempts to improve the welfare state included also approaches to social protection flooring, and also the life cycle approach, which for the first time, about 3-4 years ago, there was an attempt to get the governments for the first time to articulate a longer-term vision rather than patch-up policies that were established during early years of transition. So it wasn't enough now to simply remain on the settings that we had immediately post-transition, which was to respond to immediate needs of massive unemployment. But there was need to accommodate all the increasing needs and necessities of vulnerable groups or groups at need or marginalized groups as they are known, to also cope with limited resources, to also cope with the growth that did not deliver the jobs as it was predicated. As Wim Andersen said in the 1990s, that the existence of a program or the amount of money spent may be less important than what it actually does. And welfare state in most of the countries in the Western Balkans, in the Western Balkans, has been, the efforts of the welfare state have been very limited compared to the coping mechanisms that people themselves have found as solutions. Can the welfare state play a role in strengthening society? In this context, the welfare states in the region are faced not only with the problems of responding to the growing needs, they are also faced with various demands of the international donors, for example, IMF and World Bank international donors are very focused on the institutional reforms, and they want to increase efficiency of the systems and increase efficiency of the social schemes. This does not necessarily go in line with other priorities, which are to focus on being more inclusive and including more categories of people in need. So the policy reform over these years have focused on two things, on institutions, and by institutions I mean institutions of welfare have seen a process of renaming over the years, not changing in substance, not changing in the programs that they run, but change of the name as a way to find new context for the issues that they have tackled. They've worked on increasing efficiency. They've worked on increasing criteria, and by criteria I mean the more criteria to make institutions efficient. It has resulted in more people being excluded by the social schemes that were aimed and intended to help them. At the same time, programs have remained not further developed from when they were created in the early 1990s. There have been patching up of the existing programs, and there have been add-on criteria to those, but there hasn't been a proper policy reform and programs. Who have been the actors that have been playing a role in the policy making in the welfare efforts in the Western Balkans? The government obviously has been a key player in the policy making process, but also the civil society. Even though the civil society has turned over the years to be as just another way of finding employment for those who would otherwise be just in the job seekers' allowance, if they didn't have this chance. There have been other actors with sometimes conflicting interests. As I mentioned, interests of the World Bank and IMF not necessarily always been in line with the EU, even though in 2013 the European Commission and the World Bank declared that they were now going to work together towards a framework of human rights. It still remains to be seen whether is the World Bank going towards the EU or the EU going towards the World Bank vision for the human rights in the region. At the same time, the European Commission has remained mainly at the legislation point of intervention. They have worked a lot on improving legislation and the acquis, but have not trickled down into policy making and improving conditions for the people and categories in need. So we see that the building of these institutions, we expected that welfare efforts in the region would deliver us some models like the welfare states were built in the Western Western societies and Western countries. But those policy and institutions did not follow on time. They did not build exactly as they were intended to, because they were localized in some way, but also the picking and mixing of certain features. For example, the Bismarckian and Beveridge mixed together, they did not necessarily deliver what they were meant to deliver, also faced with the financial constraints and the jobless growth constraints in the region. At the same time, there also have been the remedial and restorative potential role of social policy has not really been explored in the region, because it has continually been overridden by political and economic crises and shocks that have been happening and trickled down in the countries, being those global but also regional. In many years ago, in some research has argued that in the countries in the Western Balkans, the state appeared to be very ineffective, as an ineffective agency in the people's lives, with the lemma that there is little incentive for people to desire or to pressure the governments for the situation to change. And this, in a way, explains also why people do not have faith in the governments. They do not push the governments for changing the situation. They tend to rely on coping mechanisms, with mass migration increasing again in the last few years, and increases in informality as well. So with retrenchments of services and growing fiscal base, with high cost and complex express needs in the countries, with growing inequalities, as we heard also from the previous presentation, the countries are facing the impossible task to either continue to perpetuate the existence of welfare states, the welfare models that they have in the region, and patching up on the existing programs, or to come up with some policy innovation. However, it is not. It is confusing for the countries whether what are the cars that they can aspire to, because initially it was a European idea. European idea as a consolidation, from transition to consolidation. The idea is that to join the European Union would be the final stage of consolidation. However, given the EU pressures that is currently facing. That is currently not an option for that most of the Western Balkans are looking positively to. Or could this be the other effort, which is also being pushed by the European Commission in the region, to harmonize the region first? So they are pushing for policies on regional trade, on regional employment, or regional policies on education, and also trying to harmonize and get these countries to learn from each other in terms of the social policy and policy innovations. What are the current innovations that are happening in these countries? One of the recent innovations that is has yet to be understood why it happened was the Albania just got rid of the Ministry of Social Welfare, and that is a very interesting solution for the current situation. Whether that is a reason because the problems were too big to handle by one institution, therefore they had to be spread across the other institutions of government, or whether, as someone said once after Enver Hoxha, this is the second time that social problems perhaps do not exist. This brings me to the latest, brings me to the last point, which is the current policy ideas and innovations in the region as regards the universal basic income experiments. These countries are faced with such difficulties. The welfare states are being questioned to the point of existence. This is not only for the Western Balkans, because 75 years after Beveridge, we're still asking the same questions for welfare states in other countries in the European Union. So can the welfare state continue as it is in these countries? Can they innovate? And if they can innovate, can they afford to even dare to think of a policy innovation such as universal basic income? And we can have a discussion whether that is desirable, whether that is affordable. But the question perhaps for these countries is, can they afford not to engage into a new thinking, new design for policy and welfare efforts in the countries? And to conclude on this, and I'd like the discussion perhaps to try to discuss on this, to detail these questions. The last point is I'm taking from Titmus, when he wrote on the commitment to welfare, that the forces of the past create new situations if the structures and functions of the social services cling too closely to the needs of the age in which they were originated. And if the interests which resist change become too powerful, these services will not meet the needs of the new situations. We shall not achieve a better balance between the needs of today and the resources of today by leaving out the destinies of tradition. By simply attending to the business of the state, without knowledge of wind and current, without some sense of purpose, men and societies do not keep afloat for long, morally or economically, by simply bailing out of the water. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I will make the presentation available for those who, because we didn't have a chance to show it, with more points to discuss, for anyone who's interested.
Well, thanks very much. This is very interesting. And I mean, one of the things that that I derive from this, I mean, of course, you see welfare systems confronted by a basic constraint, which is a shortage of resources, especially in the time of economic crisis. But you also see another set of problems. And one set of problems seems to derive from the dominance of externally conceived goals being implemented in environments that might not be well suited to them, rather than a policy environment in which goals are derived from assessment of conditions on the ground, and that this is intensified by what appears to be a lack of of coordination and coherence in those externally derived goals. And this is maybe further compounded by a very interesting resonance, and that is a resonance between a kind of anti-state ideological stance that's coming from outside, with the demand to privatize everything and make everything more efficient and so on, which seems to cohere very, very well with low levels of trust in the state that that derive from inside. And so it creates the situation where, I mean, as you argued, innovation is necessary. You know, we've talked about some of those innovations being policy proposals that are debated in other places now, including proposals like universal basic income. And maybe I could make a suggestion that another possible source of innovation could be the informal coping strategies that people have developed to deal with the situation. That is, we don't necessarily have to look at all forms of informality as merely representing bad formality or distorted formality. They might be decent answers to concrete situations that people have developed using their intelligence and ability to draw on existing social networks.
I think I'm just coming from the region, actually today, on visits to Serbia and Albania. We see that, for the first time, I'm very glad to say that we see internal efforts developing in the countries, and this is, in the case of Serbia, is actually leading research on to trying to pilot a case of universal basic income in Serbia. So this is one of the internally driven policy innovations that we see in the region, and there is also a case to be convinced in Albania, hopefully to follow soon, and which will give academic research a possibility to research these case studies and also to find out locally driven policy innovations, whether they are effective and whether they respond better to the policy patches that we have seen in the past.
So thank you. Well, I think we now have some time. How much time do we have on this?
25 minutes.
We have about 25 minutes for discussion. So should we should we take questions in blocks of three, because three is a lucky number? And then, and Will, do you want to come to the front?
Yeah.
And, yes, please go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, this relates to legacy. Will started off by describing Yugoslavia as a fairly simple whole. In other words, there was a Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia worked like this and worked like that, and that's what it was. My more limited understanding, but an understanding I have developed, is that actually Yugoslavia was never a single whole, and that with respect to its economic circumstances and its welfare state policies, there was an awful lot of difference between the different areas. Therefore, the question is, what are the changes done, given the change, the starting point? And it's so that when one talks about what's happened in Serbia, one has to remember, where did Serbia start? And where did Slovenia start? Very different levels, very different institutions, and therefore trajectories that are not surprisingly different. I'd also add to that, possibly, issues of absolute levels of income and levels of growth. I kind of remember seeing rather recently a chart which looked at some of the Balkan area, which showed very fast trajectories for a lot of countries which are performing relatively badly, so growth trajectories, and rather poor growth trajectories for Slovenia, admittedly from a much higher level.
I was just curious to ask, related to the first presentation, when you were drawing differences between Gini coefficients, did you take into account the levels of income? Because Slovenia has a much higher income per capita, so I'm not sure how this would relate with the Gini coefficient. I would expect that Serbia's inequality would be more pronounced because they have a relatively lower income per capita relative to Slovenia. So did you take into account this when you were doing your studies? So maybe it would be more a better way to see this just by comparing the extremes in income distributions, for example, the wealthiest people in Serbia compared to the wealthiest people in Slovenia.
Let's take one more and then put our presenters on the spot, if we have one more. Yes, Peter.
Well, maybe just related to that question. I wonder it's really a question about the data, and we know that data in this region are often quite unreliable, especially income data. People don't reveal fully their incomes. They have a lot of informal sources, remittances, and so on. I just wonder, you know, are you worried about that? Are you able to do robustness tests, maybe looking at spending rather than income?
Okay, so we have three questions. How diverse was Yugoslavia? Is the Gini coefficient an independent variable? And do you know what you think you know?
Go. That's a huge range of topics. The first legacy. It's clearly, it's well known that the level of economic development in the different republics of Yugoslavia was very different. And Slovenia was the most wealthy, and Kosovo was very poor and backward, for example. And that was magnified by the 1974 constitution, which gave decentralized powers to the different republics, devolution. And so the system ended up a little bit like the Eurozone today, with a sort of dinar zone with a common currency but not much else in common. But that's exaggerating, of course. I mean, there wasn't the federal budget from the fiscal point of view, was not very great. There's very little capacity to redistribute from one region to another and this sort of thing. Nevertheless, it was a one-party state. It was a country. It did have national level systems, which, despite the devolution, they were. I was surprised to hear you say that the institutions were different, and I agree fully that the level of development is different. But I'd be very interested to discuss with you the extent to which the institutions themselves were different. And certainly, when it came to child benefits or social assistance benefits, the publics have different rates or levels according to their different level of development. But the actual system itself was, as far as I'm aware, uniform across the countries. But you may have something to say about that to correct me on that. On the question between relating to the Gini coefficient and the level of development, I mean, this is something we haven't looked at as a team yet. We haven't really started the proper research. As when the colleagues come in January or February, it's probably one of the things we will do. But I mean, clearly, the issue you're raising there is the so-called and well-known cousinness theory, which is a theory of economic development developed by Simon Kuznets in the 1950s, which purported to show that as countries develop from low income to middle income to high income, there's a sort of U-shape of inequality. So initial economic development would generate more inequality, but eventually as countries got richer, the inequality would ameliorate. So clearly you could argue that Serbia is at the sort of bottom of this curve, and Slovenia is at the top end, and that as Serbia develops, inequality will reduce. Well, I mean, that may well be the case, but I mean, most of the subsequent research into that theory have pretty much shown that it's not a valid theory. It's not true that countries that are poorer and middle-income countries have higher inequality just by virtue of the fact that they're middle-income countries. There are plenty of examples of middle-income countries with high levels of equality and plenty of examples of low levels of equality. So I think as a proposition it's interesting, but I don't think it's really going to be a good explanation of what's going on. And us having, with the caveat, we haven't really explored this yet, so we may be right. Spending other than income, sure, people do don't want to divulge to the tax man their income, but it's a different question when you're talking about household surveys, which probably have, equal. It's not like the tax man's knocking on your door and asking how much you are as a surveyor. The SILC surveys, which these data are based upon, are carried out according to an EU methodology. They're commonly used surveys across the whole of the EU. They're quite sophisticated in the way they're developed from the point of view of marketing research methodologies. I'm not an expert on marketing research, so I can't answer your question, but as in technical terms. But the problem with looking at consumption as an alternative to income is that consumption streams tend to be smoothed out much more than income streams. So you would end up, when you look at Gini coefficients for consumption, with much lower levels of inequality than when you look at Gini coefficients for income. And that's most likely due to the fact that this sort of consumption is smoothing. And because obviously there's a limit to how much you consume it, so it's more compressed scale. That's what I would say. I think Gorana Krstić is the expert on this in this field. She's a statistician from Serbia, and she's using these surveys in her analyses. And as far as robustness tests, that'd be my term. Sorry. But I don't think that can be an explanation. I don't think it can be an explanation of high inequality in Serbia that somehow some people are hiding their income. If it was true, then you would expect to find lower inequality. If the top end people were hiding their income from their surveyors, then you would actually have less inequality in those countries where the people are more likely to hide and be devious. And I think Eric saying that this sort of behaviour may be culturally determined, whether it's sort of systematically determined between countries.
Do you
want to
elaborate a little bit on this?
Because I think there's a basic problem we always face. We all know that there's some volume of economic activity that is not accounted for by the statistics that we have available. But do we have any idea how much that might be?
There are lots of different surveys available. The SILC survey, there's the labour force survey. So labour force survey is looking at employment and unemployment, and it measures things like the in type of employment, so it measures informality, and that seems to give a pretty good picture of the level, high levels of informality in the Western Balkan countries. We have tax evasion, people who are working in an informal job where the employer isn't paying their social security, and measuring, I think it's sort of 22% informal economy in Serbia, but I don't think anybody's really saying that that's way out of what actually might be the case. It's not like there's actually a measuring 22% with only 10%, or they're measuring 22% when it's 40%. And it may be they're measuring 22% when it's 23%, but there's always error in surveys. It's the nature of a survey, because you're taking just a sample. The statisticians sort of have some ways of accounting for that, and there is an irreducible level of inaccuracy in all these these data, but I don't think it's any worse in the Western Balkans than in any other country. Perhaps it is, but
can I ask Hugo, this comes back a bit to the question which I put, but it comes back to the descriptions that we've had of what things look like now. Part of my question was, what did things used to look like relative to what they look like now? In other words, has Slovenia, which I've just come back to, always more or less looked like Slovenia looks like, or did it look different relative to the rest of Yugoslavia in the good old days? And so I'm looking at sort of what has been the value added or the value destroyed as a result of the transformation in these different countries and the trajectories which people have taken. Was Slovenia always relatively formal, relatively equal? Were the structures, and this is the thing which I'm relatively certain about, were the structures much more highly developed in a certain direction in a country like Slovenia and in a country like Serbia, where there were very different structures which then reproduced themselves in the construction of policy, how policy is made, and what objectives one should be following? I just named two countries out of the ones, but I think one could make that even more, well, one would make it all the more complicated the more countries that one started to add. Why did somewhere like Croatia go totally in a totally different direction? We don't actually know that. We've had a description of it, but if it did go in a different direction, where did it come from to relative to where it has ended up?
Well, I mean, that's a hugely broad question, isn't it? Because you're asking me to talk about what Slovenia looks like without saying, in which dimension Slovenia looks like something in all different policy areas. I mean, we have the Acquis Communautaire with 35 chapters, each of which contains thousands of policy areas. So I don't know what you're talking about.
I could say to you, some of those graphs which you showed, which had a picture of what things are like today, I'm assuming they're more or less what they're like today. The level of informality. Mm. I mean, a lot of those are snapshot pictures, but if you took the political structures, the social structures, the type of labour markets, the kind of formality or informality, the kind of job quality across sectors, across countries. I'm just wondering, I'm trying to get this concept of value.
Let me answer then. The ranking of inequalities is pretty much the same today as it was in Yugoslavia. So Slovenia always was slightly more equal than Serbia. I should bear in mind that the Yugoslav economy also had a very, very large private sector. So there were private incomes in play, as well as the social incomes and the welfare state. So there were structural differences between the republics to do with, for example, the southern republics being more agricultural, for example. And that obviously had something to do with it, because agricultural incomes tend to be lower than industrial incomes. So that sort of thing. So there clearly, there were, as I said, differences between the republics, and there are, so in that sense it was not a one country, but on the other hand it was, I would still argue, one system. And since then there have been massive institutional reforms which have changed the systems. In Slovenia probably less so than the other parts, because as I said, one of the explanations of the low level of inequality in Slovenia is that it's pursued a gradualist path of transition, which didn't change the institutions very much. Whereas in the other countries, there was massive privatisation, there was massive policy reform, massive change in political interest and so on, that brought about huge changes. So Yeah, if you think of the Gini coefficient for inequality in Yugoslavia was 0.2, in Slovenia it moved up to 0.3 with the introduction of markets. It's not very much change. Whereas in Serbia it moved up to 0.6, market inequality. There's clearly massive change going on there. So although you know, you're right to point to the differences between the republics previously,
I'm interested.
I'm interested in why there are these massive changes. Well, because of the, as I said, I think I gave three explanations at the end. You know, one is being the pace and nature of the transition process.
I think that we can do another round of questions. The only thing that I would ask is that people make their questions very brief because it increases the probability that you'll receive an answer. go ahead. Yes.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for the two very interesting presentations. Question number one, what is the impact of the war, the civil war, on these calculations? Because clearly Slovenia has been very differently impacted by the civil war than say, Serbia. Is there any way of assessing that? Second, I was stricken by the characterization of this EU policy of internal harmonization, regional harmonization first before. This is something that the EU tried to use and with the other transition countries back in the early 1990s as a strategy, and it miserably failed. So the idea was, you know, first you integrate internally all these post-communist countries, and then you enter. This failed, and I think that's a very powerful historic experience that can be brought forward collectively by of course, the EU knows. I'd like to finally take perhaps a differing view on the characterization of this liberal big bank market driven late liberal reform of Serbia versus Slovenia's well thought through nice gradual socially conscious transformation, because maybe I don't speak about the latter. Much better experts, but on the former, I think a major issue in Serbia has been that it was not a real market transformation. That competition, market entry was not efficient, and that created the monopolistic oligarchic positions that you yourself refer to. So if that's true, then it would. I don't think it's consistent with the characterization of a truly liberal market-based reform.
Thank you. Yes.
So I have a question, short question for Will. You said that international organizations had different influence in different countries, Serbia and Bosnia had more of an IMF influence versus the others. How did you come to that point? And the other question is to the other speaker, is there any explanation why Albania stuck for 7 years for the seven PRSP reports? What's the story behind? Thank you.
Yes. Question for Ms. Tahir. So taking into account that there are a large number of projects and strategies implemented in the Western Balkans regarding the social policies and changing the situation there. But okay, one factor in this non-implementation of policies and not showing results is the lack of institutional lack, which you mentioned. But are there any other factors such as education or culture? Because I remember very well when I did a research 2 years ago in the Western Balkans, and when I interviewed people and I asked them about the EU conditional policies, they had no information on these policies. So, yeah.
Okay. Can you let Let's take one more before you start answering.
Just a brief question from Toreda. You mentioned that civil society was used as a job, as a place to find jobs, and was this the only or the dominant role of civil society? I mean, it just captured my attention why you mentioned it, and in dealing with this emergency at that time.
On the first question, on the regional, why the regional harmonization on this as a policy had failed successfully before, I think perhaps it hasn't been thought as a long-term strategy on behalf of the EU for the region. But I suppose when the EU is facing other internal problems, starting that from with Brexit, with the Catalan vote, with even the Scottish independence, the sort of issues that EU itself, its own existence is sort of facing these problems. The issue is, would EU take the steps to take individual countries as a part of the enlargement process, or would it rather take the region as a whole? So these have not been necessarily openly declared as the intention on behalf of the EU, but if we notice that all the initiatives that are going on in the region, we see that there are being created in all these various aspects that I mentioned that are created regional efforts. Therefore, there is an attempt to harmonize this, as well as working on the legislation on these countries for the acquis. So, would these experiences show something that it failed in the past? Could fail again? We don't know. We're yet to see that whether it would work. But this is what is currently going on. So, could be that the European Commission, the European Union, is playing a sort of a waiting game for the region while it deals with its own problems. The region can put efforts to sort of harmonize and so. The second question was why Albania engaged so long with the growth and poverty reduction strategy. There is also the question who actually advised the growth and poverty reduction strategies in these countries, because as I said, not all of the Balkan countries engage in the growth and poverty reduction strategies. So we see, like I said, four or five countries among all of the other countries. So whether this was because it was pushed by the World Bank, and in those countries the World Bank and IMF had more of the central, sort of more of an important role in policy design and more of the international actors, that affected policy design in these countries. And Albania perhaps has had the tendency to always ally with the World Bank has been influential in the policy design at a time when the EU has been almost absent. So the impact of EU policy in Albania has been almost sort of ineffective, only stopping at the legislation improvements. So in that sense, Albania entertained the idea also because it also engaged in the shock therapy of post-transition. Initially, it predicated the welfare efforts in saying, we'll suffer today, but we'll get a brighter future tomorrow. So we'll engage into these policies that will bring us growth and will bring social goods for the people, but did sort of persisted with it, but did not lead to the intended outcomes. And then later on, moved on to other things. The strategy itself changed names over the years as well to accommodate also the interests of also other actors in the game of policy making. So
can I have a two handed on this PRRC, because it's an interesting, it's something that I'm quite familiar with, having worked actually in the IMF at the time. So it's granted that that was pretty much a World Bank driven, not IMF, let's just be very clear, World Bank driven process. At the same time, the beauty of that process was actually an inclusiveness that was never there before for macroeconomic policy engagement. I'm not saying decision making, but an engagement. And an important part of that was civil society. In some of the countries, including in Albania, with all due respect, there was very little civil society to speak of. And this process actually started building, and that Africa was very clear, at least brought in elements, and I'm not saying building up, but they helped strengthen those elements which already were there from civil society. the whole PRSC was more a process than anything else, with a macro policy with more engagement. I'm not saying it was not, you know, top down, but there was a much more element of trying to be more inclusive and bottom up as before.
I'm not doubting the intentions of the policy. The point is to, when we discuss why the policy continued for so long and whether it was a macro, as you say, it was an economic policy. And the social impacts were meant to be trickled down from the economic growth that this, by including all actors, the main actors. I have been part of the process, so I know that. But it did not result into what it claimed to achieve. It did not gain that, and that is why, sort of after 8 years of trying to accommodate for this and hoping that it would, the economic growth would also have social impacts, it sort of diverted into other policy innovations and renaming other policy programs as well. So I'm not doubting the intentions of the policy. But also it also reflects on the point that we often see in the Balkans, that is the economics and the politics that drive the agenda. It's not the social issues. You hardly see any political party in the region. They're winning elections because they come up with the promise of solving social issues. And if we make a comparison here, how much it became a political issue here, the bedroom tax in the UK. This is not an issue that will become a political issue in the region, and we know that they can't win elections on these promises. Therefore, social issues are always 10 paces behind the economic and political promises.
So social issues are not really locally kind of provide, you know, derived, according to that.
Is because also, like I said before, I mentioned that is state itself has not been an efficient mechanism. Therefore, people do not have faith that by putting pressure on the government, things are going to change. Therefore, they're trying to cope to build their own coping mechanisms. With still high levels of migration even going on today, it tells us a lot about the impacts of policy over the years. So I think this is one of the problems. And with, as I said, with a weak civil society, and I'm not saying necessarily the civil society came initially post-transition as an agenda of issues brought from international donors. And this one aspect that I'll pick here is the gender issues, for example. As we are talking, for example, in the case of Albania, there was Albania had the high emancipation rate during communism, and yet with what came with the massive unemployment, the agenda for gender equality was pushed into the country. However, what we see is that this was an agenda pushed by the donors and not necessarily supported at the local level by the needs of the country. So in this respect, we see also even today, you mentioned also that in the case of Serbia, for example, the domestic violence being an issue. And we see that all this, when the issues are sort of, you know, internationally driven and not localized, not owned by either the government or the civil society, we see that the impacts of those initiatives are always limited. We see that in the campaigns of against gender-based violence, for example, for years campaigns have been going on. We see people are aware now after so many years, but we don't see a change happening. So the question is, they are good, these campaigns may be very good at informing people, but they are not achieving the change because these strategies and these policies are not owned by the people. So locally lacking the local component.
Yeah, you had two other questions. One is non-institutional factors, and the other is the economic role of civil society.
The question was other factors other than institutional, right? Since most people do not have any idea about the EU policy set. Yes, there was an opinion poll carried out a few years ago, probably 7 years ago, when people were asked, in this case in Albania, how they associated European Union membership. And for most people, that was the ability to travel free, visa free. So this shows that people weren't informed, but also the government had not much interest into educating people what EU membership would be and what would be the cost of that. So in that case, yes, there is a lack of information, and it's seen as sort of it was seen as a pragmatic way to offer this membership. But here there are other factors, and like I said, there are institutional factors, weak institutions. We have a weak civil society in the region, and because that has it has been dependent on the donors' agenda as well as funding. It has not been able to actually move away and create its own sort of local agenda of issues that are based on the country. So if the donors withdrew their funding, we would see a very, very non-existent civil society. So this is the question, how is civil society being built and how is it strengthened in these countries? And your question was, well, when I said that, yeah, how, I think there are, civil society is part of, again, this picture of weak institutions and lack of faith in the government institutions as well, that change can happen. Therefore, initially, it was absolutely an opportunity to be employed. Post-transition, civil society was just a form of employment for people who couldn't get jobs. So there was a government and there was a civil society and there was a lot of money put in the... Later on, that we see a development of this sector with some organizations trying to depict and to sort of promote issues that are relevant in the country, but not necessarily a very strong voice. So we don't see them, we don't see civil society organizations protesting, for example, against social issues, for social issues, for social rights, but we see them sort of mainly joining sometimes even political agenda of issues in the country.
So, well, I think that leads to really the extent of damage that can be attributed to the wars.
Yes, okay. Well, just on the second question from the spectacles. I agree very much with what you're saying, that it's not just a question of the speed of transition, it's obviously to do with the institutional development which took place in the different countries. You know, that's basically what we are planning to be looking at as we do the research project. On the civil wars, I think that links very much with the person's question about the influence of international organisations, because they were brought in more in those areas where there was more damage and more conflict. So, I mean, civil wars obviously have an impact on the entire economic situation and therefore on the levels of inequality. You know, there's first of all, there's migration, maybe migration of skilled people leaving the country. There's destruction of the capacity and the, for example, the industrial structure in Bosnia, which was quite heavily industrialized and where the arms industry was large, a lot of that was based in Bosnia before the war, was 90% of that was destroyed. You know, it hasn't been built up. So there have been huge structural changes and there's been deindustrialization across the region, but particularly in those places where conflict was larger, a shift towards service economies, and that has big implications for the structure of inequality. But having said that, I mean, probably in Serbia there was less conflict, but on the other hand we see this higher inequality than in Croatia, which was more badly affected, and Macedonia. So, the way in which conflict has affected inequality is quite not just a sort of one-to-one thing. There's a lot of different factors at play and a lot of different influence changes that civil conflict generates that lead to the outcomes. Certainly one thing seems to be, if you look at the Western Balkans compared to other transition regions, the enormous influence and presence of international organizations sort of is very striking. And the amount of resources and funds that have been thrown into the region for reconstruction and institutional reform and EU accession and this sort of thing is extraordinary. Especially when I think in Kosovo, there was per capita, the resources transferred were the highest in any country in the world, practically, over a long period of time. However, the impact, the effect of these resources has been virtually minimal in terms of, obviously you can see cases where there, you know, there've been bridges reconstructed and new roads built and all these sorts of things, but the actual economic development of the economies in general as a whole, the impact seems to be very low. I mean, what's been the impact on income distribution is an interesting question, and one potential impact is that the international organisations which go into the countries are often hiring the most skilled people because they're able to pay more, and so there's a sort of internal brain drain, if you like, into the international organisations away from governments, and that might have you know, repercussions which are worth considering. And as far as interventions such as PRSP and other, many other interventions designed to reduce poverty and promote economic development. I mean, what was noticed was that there was often, you know, off-the-shelf programs and projects and measures introduced by international organizations which had been successful elsewhere and brought into a different context. And then because you have so many different international organizations, you know, multilateral, bilateral, EU, World Bank, you know, German Aid Fund, Durban Fund, you know, Sweden, Swiss, multiple international organizations, they're all giving advice to governments with perhaps weak capacity, and they're coming in with lots of money. You know, it's sort of a revolving door. Some organization comes in, you know, hey, would you like 10 million for this if you introduce this policy? Yes, thank you very much. And then someone else coming in, would you like sort of 50 million for this if you introduce this policy? Yes, thank you very much. So you get a mishmash of policies, and you get completely sort of incoherent, inconsistent policy direction, which appears to be, the lack of administrative capacity, but I often wonder whether it's not actually lack of administrative capacity, it's actually very good administrative capacity to grab as much as possible from the international donors. And what looks like a lack of capacity is actually simply the incoherence of the policy menu which results from that.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And before we thank the speakers in the panel, Alexandra, do you want to let people know about the next event?
Yes, the next event is going to be on the 21st of November. I'm just going to read it out here. It's called Democratization, European Integration and Identity, Attitudes Towards the EU Across the EU Member States and the Western Balkans. It's going to be here, this room, on the Monday 20th of November. Well, you can find this on our website.
And we can also email, right?
Yes.
Okay, so thank you, everybody. Thank you to the presenters. Thank you all.